It's hard to look into his eyes now, but in the last month, I've become an expert at hard things. Knower?
Who are you?
His eyes are burning with something, a kind of fury, and they make the irises icy. They don't seem like contacts anymore. Or did you just screw her and screw her over? There's a tap on my shoulder. Stoner Richard is behind me.
I've got to be up in the morning, he tells me.
I'm done here. It's getting on for midnight, and I've had 3 hours sleep and have forgotten to eat another meal. And I'm shaky. I manage to walk to the front of the club before I stumble. Richard grabs my arm, and it's then that I make the mistake of turning around to throw one last death ray at the cocksure, shallow, pretty boy poser, Ben McAllister. I wish I hadn't, because when I look at Ben McAllister one last time, he has this expression on his face. It's the particular contortion when fury meets guilt. And I know that look. I see it every day in the mirror. Chapter 6. That night, I crash on the velour couch in my clothes. I wake up Sunday morning with Pete and Repeat sleeping on my chest and face. Either I've claimed their couch, or they've claimed me. I sit up in time to see the last roommate, who's been invisible all weekend, drop a cereal bowl in the sink and disappear out the back door. "Bye, Harry," Alice calls after him. So that's Harry. According to Meg, he mostly stayed in his room with his many computers and his jars of fermented kimchi. Alice goes into the kitchen and returns with a cup of coffee for me, which she announces is free-range and fair-trade and shade-farmed in Malawi, and I nod along as if my coffee needs go beyond hot and caffeinated. I sit on the couch watching the cats take playful swipes at each other's faces. One of Repeat's ears gets stuck inside out. I flick it straight for him, and he mewls. It's the most helpless sound, and like it or not, there's no way I can take these guys to a shelter, no kill or otherwise. After I drink my coffee, I take my phone out onto the porch where someone has set up a bunch of empty beer bottles in bowling pin formation. I call Tricia. It's only 10:30, but miraculously she answers. "How's the big city?" she asks. "Big?" I reply. "Look, how do you feel about me bringing home a pair of kittens?"
"How do you feel about living someplace else?"
"It would be temporary, until I find them a good home."
"Forget it, Cody. I raised you for 18 years. I'm not taking on any more helpless creatures."
There are many things I resent about that sentiment. Not the least is the implication that I'm a helpless creature that she's coddled for years. I'd say I raised myself, but that would be unfair to the Garcias. When I got strep throat, it was Sue who noticed the gook on my tonsils and took me to the pediatrician for antibiotics. When I got my period, it was Sue who bought me pads. Tricia had just waved to the tampons in the medicine cabinet for when the time comes, not seeming to understand how terrifying the thought of inserting anything supersize absorbency might be to a 12-year-old. As for the 50 hours of driving practice I needed to get my driver's license, Tricia logged all of 3 of them. Joe did the remaining 47, spending countless Sunday afternoons in the car with me and Meg. "I might be here a few more days," I say. "Can you cover me at Ms. Mason's on Monday? There's $40 in it for you."
"Sure."
Tricia jumps at the money. She doesn't ask me why I'm delayed or when I'll be home. I call the Garcias next. It's a little trickier with them because if I mention the kittens, they'll offer to take them in, even though the way Samson is around cats, it would be a disaster. I tell Sue I need a day or two longer to tie up a few of Meg's loose ends. She sounds relieved, doesn't ask any more questions, just tells me to take as much time as I need. I'm about to hang up. Then she says, And Cody? I hate those and Codys. It's like a gun being cocked. Like they're about to tell me they know everything. Yeah? There's a long pause on the phone. My heart starts to pound. Thank you, is all Sue says. Inside, I ask Alice about the best way to find homes for the kittens. Good homes. You could put an ad on Craigslist, but I heard sometimes those animals wind up in research labs. Not helpful. Well, we could put up flyers. Everyone likes pictures of kittens. I sigh. Fine. How should we do that? Easiest to take a picture of the cats. Maybe email it to yourself, add some text, and print them out, she begins. It might be simpler to use Meg's laptop. It has a built-in camera. The $1,800 computer her parents got her when she left for college. They're still paying off the credit card bill for that. I go up to her room and find the computer in one of the boxes. I turn it on. It's password protected, but I put in Runtmeyer, and her desktop pops up. I bring the computer downstairs while Alice poses the cats together, which is harder than you'd think, and I understand where the expression herding kittens comes from. Finally, I snap a picture. Alice quickly uses the desktop publishing function to make up a flyer, and I take the thing back to Meg's printer to print out a test copy. I'm about to shut down her computer when I stop. Her email program is right there, right at the toolbar on the bottom. And without even thinking about it, I click it open. Immediately a bunch of new mail downloads, junk mostly, crap from anonymous people who don't know she's dead, though there are one or two Meg, we miss you, emails, and one telling her she's going to rotten hell because suicide is a sin. I delete that one. I'm curious to know what the last email Meg sent was. Who was it to? Was it the suicide note? As I click over to the sent mail folder, I look around as if someone is watching me. But of course, no one is. It's not the suicide note. She composed that 2 days before she died, and as we now know, set it to deliver automatically the day after she died. After the suicide note, she wrote a handful of emails, including one to the library, contesting a fine for an overdue book. She knew she was going to die and she was worried about library fines. How can a person do that? How can they make a decision like that, write an email like that, and then just carry on? If you can do that, can't you keep carrying on? I check more of the sent mails. There's one to Scotty the week she died. It just says, "Hey, Runtmeyer, I love you. Always." Was that her goodbye? Did she send me a goodbye that I somehow missed? I scroll back some more, but it's odd. There's a bunch of messages from the week before she died, then a big 6-week gap of nothing. Then it picks up again back in January. I'm about to shut the whole thing down when I see something Meg sent to a big bad Ben at podmail.com a few days before she died. I hesitate for a moment. Then I open it. "You don't have to worry about me anymore." Smiley face. It's a different kind of goodbye. And in spite of the happy face, I can feel her heartbreak and rejection and defeat. Things I've never associated with Meg Garcia. I go into her inbox and search for emails from Big Bad Ben. They stretch back to the fall, and the first bunch are mostly quick and witty, one-line bits of banter. At least from him. I can't see her responses here, only his side of the conversation, because his email lopped off her side with every reply. The early emails are after Meg first saw him play. A bunch of, "Thanks for coming to my show. Thanks for being so nice when the band sucks so bad." Bullshit self-deprecation that a 6-year-old could see through. There are some notes about upcoming gigs.
Then the tone turns more chummy, then flirty. In one message, he dubs her Mad Meg. In another, he goes on about her electric shit-kickers, which must be the orange snakeskin cowboy boots she picked up at the Goodwill and wore everywhere. There are a couple in which he calls her insane, because everyone knows that Keith Moon is hands down the best drummer in the world. There are a few more with this kind of rock talk that Meg could flirt in for days. But then, there is this abrupt change in tone. "It's cool. We're still friends," he writes. "But I can feel the discomfort even here, 3 steps and 4 months removed." I look at her sent mail to see what she wrote to him. I see the early stuff, her side of the banter about Keith Moon, but I can't see what prompted the later emails, because again, there's that chunk of missing sent email. Almost all of January and February is wiped out. Weird. I click back to Ben's emails to her. Another email says, "Don't worry about it." Another asks her not to call him that late. Another says, not quite so reassuringly, that yeah, they're still friends. Another email asks if she took his Mud Honey t-shirt, and if so, can he have it back because it was his dad's. And then I read one of the last ones he sent. One simple sentence, so brutal, it makes me hate Ben McAllister with ice in my veins. "Meg, you have to leave me alone." Yeah, she left you alone, all right. Yesterday, I'd found a large t-shirt, black and white and red, neatly folded. I didn't recognize it, so I'd put it in the giveaway pile. I grab it now. It says Mud Honey, his precious t-shirt. He couldn't even let her have that. I go back to the laptop and with fury in my fingers send a new email to Big Bad Ben from Meg's account with the subject line, "Back from the dead." "Your precious t-shirt, that is," I write. "There's a limit on miracles and second comings." I don't sign it, and before I have a chance to overthink it, I've already pressed send. It takes all of 30 seconds for regret to set in, and I remember why I hate email. When you write a letter like, say, to your father, you can scrawl pages and pages of all the things you think are so important because you don't know where he lives, and even if you did, there'd be all that time to find an envelope and a stamp, and by that point, you would have ripped up the letter. But then one time, you track down an email address and you're near a computer with internet access, so you don't have that nice cushion, and you type what you're feeling and press send before you have a chance to talk yourself out of it. And then you wait, and wait, and wait, and nothing comes back. So all those things you thought were so important to say, really, they weren't. They weren't worth saying at all. Alice and I blanket the part of Tacoma near the college with kitten flyers. Then she gets the smart idea of putting them up around this fancy health food store where the rich people shop. We take the bus, and on the way she tells me the place isn't a Whole Foods, but they might get a Whole Foods here soon. And when I say, "How thrilling," Alice says, "I know," not catching the sarcasm at all. So I look out the window, hoping she'll shut up. The trip is a bust, because the store manager won't let us hang flyers inside. So we hand them out to the well-heeled customers with their recycled bags, and they all look at us like we're offering them free crack samples. It's after 5 by the time we get back, and even perky Alice is flagging. I'm furious and frustrated. I can't believe it is this hard to find homes for kittens, and the whole thing seems like some kind of sick joke, with Meg getting the last laugh. The house smells of cooking, a weird, unpleasant odor of spices that don't go together. Curry, rosemary, too much garlic. Tree is back, sitting on the couch, drinking a beer. "I thought you were leaving," Tree says coolly. Alice tacks one of the cat flyers onto the bulletin board by the door, next to a large flyer for tomorrow's Lifeline vigil.
She explains how I'm trying to find homes for Pete and Repeat. Tree makes a face. What? You have something against kittens? I ask her. She wrinkles her nose. It's just Pete and Repeat. Those names. They're so gay. I'm bisexual, and I don't appreciate your derogatory use of gay, Alice says, attempting to sound scolding, but still somehow managing to sound chipper. Well, sorry. I know they're the dead girl's cats, but the names are still gay. When she says this, Tree seems less like a hippie than like one of the rednecks in her town. It makes me hate her both more and less. What names do you prefer? I ask. Without hesitating, she says, Click and Clack. That's what I call them in my head. And you think Pete and Repeat are bad? Stoner Richard asks, appearing with a stained apron and a wooden spoon. I think we should call them Lenny and Steve. Those aren't cat names, Alice says.
Why not?
Stoner Richard asks, holding up the spoon, the contents of which bear the strange odor of the kitchen.
Who wants a bite?
What is it? Tree asks.
Everything in the fridge stew.
You should add the cats, Tree says. Then she wouldn't have to find homes for them. I thought you were a vegetarian, Alice says acidly. Stoner Richard invites me to share his horrible concoction. It smells like the spices got into a rumble and everyone lost. Though that's not the reason I decline. I'm not used to company. I'm not sure when that happened. I used to have friends. Not good ones. But friends. From school. From town. I used to be at the Garcias all the time. Used to. Seems far from where I am now. I leave the roommates to their meal and go into the kitchen for a drink. I bought a liter of Dr. Pepper earlier and stowed it in the fridge, but Stoner Richard, in his zeal to cook, has moved everything, so I have to dig for it. And there, in the back, I find a couple of unopened cans of RC, and my stomach drops out, because the only person I've ever known to drink that is Meg. I fill an old Sonic's cup with ice and RC. When I leave here, I don't want to leave even the smallest part of her behind. I take my drink to the empty porch, but when I get there, I see the porch isn't empty, and I stop so suddenly the drink sloshes out of the cup and onto my shirt. He's smoking a cigarette, the cherry of it burning menacingly in the dim, gray twilight. I don't know what surprises me most— that an email I sent actually had an impact, or that he looks like he wants to kill me. I don't give him the chance. I put my drink down on the porch railing and turn around and go upstairs, trying to take them slowly, trying to act calm. He's here for the shirt. So I'll get him the shirt, throw it in his face, and get him the hell out of here. I hear the sound of crunching gravel, and then I hear him on the stairs behind me, and I'm not sure what to do. Because if I call out for help, then I look weak. But I saw that look in his eyes. It's like he not only got my email, but he got my hatred, too. And now it's cycling back to me. I go into Meg's room. His T-shirt sits on top of one of the piles where I left it. He's followed me upstairs and is standing in her doorway. I hurl the shirt at him. I want him. Every part of him out of my space. But he just stands there. The shirt bounces off him and falls to the floor. What the fuck? He asks. What? You wanted your shirt. There's your shirt. What kind of person does that? What did I do? You said you wanted your T-shirt. Oh, cut the crap, Cody. He interrupts. And it's so startling to hear him say my name. Not Cowgirl Cody in his stupid flirtatious growl, but my name, plain, naked. You sent me an email from a dead girl. Are you cruel? Or are you also some kind of crazy? You wanted your T-shirt back, I repeat, but now I'm scared, so it loses some of its conviction. He glares at me.
His eyes are a whole different color here, in the pale light of Meg's room. And then I remember Meg's last email. "You don't have to worry about me anymore." And the anger comes back.
"Couldn't you let her have a souvenir?"
I ask. "Maybe you should do that, with the number of girls you probably screw. Hand out a commemorative T-shirt. But asking for it back? Now that's classy."
"You obviously don't know what you're talking about."
"So enlighten me." There's an edge of desperation in my voice. Because he's right. I don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe if I'd known, if I'd been more clued in these last few months, we wouldn't be standing here. He stares at me like I am something putrid, and I can't believe that this is the same smarmy flirt from last night.
"What happened?"
I ask. "Did you get bored with her? Is that what happens with you and girls? It's a failure of imagination, because if you had gotten to know her at all, you would never have gotten tired of her. I mean, she was Meg Garcia, and who the hell are you, Ben McAllister, to tell her to leave you alone?" My voice threatens to crack, but I won't let it. There will be time to lose it later. There's always time to lose it later. Ben's face changes now. Ice crystals form.
"How do you know what I told her?"
"I saw your email. Meg, you have to leave me alone." It sounded cruel before. But now, coming from me, it just sounds pitiful. His face is pure annihilation.
"I don't know what's more disgusting, reading a dead girl's email or writing from a dead girl's email."
"Takes disgusting to know disgusting," I say, now a third grader. He looks at me, shaking his head. And then he leaves. His precious T-shirt, a sad, forgotten rag on the floor. Chapter 7. It takes about an hour after Ben leaves for me to calm down, and another hour after that to get the nerve to turn Meg's laptop back on. Ben was right about one thing. I didn't really know what I was talking about. The way he said that suggested Meg had done something to deserve his assholishness. I know Meg, and I know guys like Ben. I've seen enough of them go through Trisha over the years. I open Meg's email program again and go into her sent folder, but all I see are the earlier emails, the ones from November. Her side of the flirtation, stuff about which musician wrote the best songs, who was the best drummer, which band was the most overhyped, underhyped, and then, before the holidays, it all abruptly stops. It doesn't take a genius to see what happened. They slept together. Then he tossed Meg aside. But what's less clear is this hole in Meg's messages. I know we didn't correspond much in the winter, but I'm pretty sure she wrote me some emails. I log on to my webmail program just to be sure I didn't imagine it. And while January is kind of a blank, there are messages from February from her in my inbox. But those messages aren't showing up in her sent folder. That's weird. Did her computer have some sort of virus that ate several weeks of messages? Or did she move her messages somewhere? I start looking through her other applications, not sure what I'm looking for. I open up her calendar, but it's empty. I check the trash, thinking maybe the deleted files will be there. There's a bunch of stuff there, but most of what I open is gibberish. There's one untitled folder. I try to open it, but the computer says I can't open it in the trash. I drag the folder to the desktop and try again. But this time I get a message that the file is encrypted. I'm afraid it might have some virus that'll fry her computer, so I drag it back to the trash. It's only 9:30, and I have not eaten, yet again, and I'm thirsty but don't feel like going back downstairs. So I take off my clothes and lie down in Meg's haunted bed.
And right now, the sheets smelling like her are kind of what I need. I know that by sleeping here, I'll mingle my smell with hers, lessen hers, but somehow that doesn't matter. That's the way it always was before, anyhow. Chapter 8. I wake the next morning to a gentle rapping at my door. Bright sunlight is coming through the open shade. I sit up in the bed. My head is full of sand. There's more knocking. Come in. My voice is a croak. Alice is standing there, another mug of coffee in her hand, harvested by hand, by Nicaraguan dwarves, no doubt. I rub my eyes, accept the coffee with a grunt of gratitude. What time is it?
It's noon.
Noon? I slept like 14 hours.
I know.
She looks around the room.
Maybe it wasn't Meg. Maybe this room is like that field of poppies in The Wizard of Oz and has a soporific effect.
What do you mean?
She slept an awful lot. Like, all the time. If she wasn't hanging out with her cool Seattle friends, she makes air quotes here, then she was sleeping. Meg liked to sleep a lot. She ran at such high octane. She needed the sleep to rejuvenate. Alice looks skeptical. I never met a person who slept as much as that. Also, she had mono in 10th grade, I explain. And as soon as I say it, I remember how awful that year was. Meg was out of school as much as she was in it. Whole months she had to do independent study because she was so laid flat.
Mono?
Alice asks. Why would that make her tired still?
She had a really bad case of it, I reply, remembering how the Garcias wouldn't let me come over and see her, in case I caught it too.
Sounds more like Epstein-Barr or something.
She sits down on the edge of her bed.
I didn't know that about her. I didn't get to know her very well.
You only moved in a few months ago. She shrugs.
I know the others, and I don't think they got to know her either. She was a little standoffish.
If Meg loved you, she loved you. And if she didn't, the girl didn't suffer fools. You just have to try to get to know her.
I did, Alice insists.
You can't have tried that hard. I mean, there couldn't have been a wellspring of love to put that album cover up on the door. Alice's Bambi eyes fill with tears.
We didn't put that up. She did. And we were told not to take anything down.
Meg put the cover up. I'm sure the suicide experts would call that a warning sign, a call for help. But it's hard not to see Meg's twisted sense of humor in it somehow. A final calling card.
Oh, I say. That actually makes sense. It does? Alice asks. It seems so morbid to me. But like I said, I didn't know much about her. I've probably spent more time with you than I did with her, she says wistfully.
I wish I could say you weren't missing much, but you were.
Tell me about her. What was she like?
What was she like?
Alice nods. She was like...
I open my arms to show bigness, the possibilities being endless. I'm not sure if this describes Meg, or how I always felt when I was around her. Alice looks so beseeching, so I tell her more. I tell her about the time Meg and I got seasonal jobs as telemarketers, the most boring job in the world. And to keep us entertained, Meg did all these different voices for the calls. She wound up doing so well with her voices and selling so much of the crap that she surpassed her daily quota and kept getting sent home early. I tell her about the time our local library's budget got slashed so badly that it could only open 3 days a week, which was a major drag for me, because when I wasn't at the Garcias, I practically lived at the place. Meg didn't use the library nearly as much as me,
but that didn't stop her from going on a mission to stop the closures. She finagled one of those moderately known, now hugely famous bands she'd become friendly with from her blog to play a Kill Rock Stars Not Books benefit concert, which brought people from all over the place to our town and raised some $12,000, which was great. But because the band was already well known and Meg was such an attractive poster child, we wound up getting all this national press, and the library was shamed into extending its hours. I tell her about when Scotty, always a picky eater, got so bad that he became anemic. The doctor said he had to eat more iron-rich food, and Sue was beside herself, because the kid would not eat healthy, no matter what. But Meg knew Scotty was obsessed with tractors, so she went on eBay and found these tractor-shaped food molds and mashed up potatoes and meat and spinach and put it all in a tractor mold, and Scotty gobbled it up. Then there was the time Trisha and I had the world's worst fight, and I ran away to find my dad, even though Trisha claimed he'd moved away years ago. I got as far as Moses Lake before I ran out of money and courage, and just as I was about to start blubbering and lose my shit, Meg and Joe pulled up. They'd been trailing my bus the whole time. But I don't tell Alice about that, because that's the kind of story you share with a good friend. And I've only ever had one of those. So that was Meg, I say, finishing up. She could do anything, solve anything for anyone. Alice pauses, digesting that. Except for herself. Chapter 9. The latest Megan Louisa Garcia funeral show is being held at a small promontory down on the Sound. A guitar player and a violinist play that Joan Osborne song, Lumina. Someone reads some Khalil Gibran. The crowd isn't huge. About 20 people, and everyone's wearing their regular clothes. The guy running the show is from the campus counseling center, but thankfully, he doesn't turn the whole thing into a suicide prevention public service announcement, bulleting all the different warning signs that we all so clearly missed. He talks about despair, how it thrives in silence. It's one of the things that drive people like Meg to do what they did, and in the aftermath, the despair that she left behind, even for people who may not have known her, has to be honored and felt. Then he looks out at the assembled group, and even though I've never met him, and even though I'm sitting off to the side next to Alice, and even though it was only begrudgingly that I agreed to go to this thing because I felt bad about accusing Alice of putting up that poison idea cover, his eyes stop on me. I know a lot of us are struggling to make sense of this. That we didn't know Meg well might make the burden less, but it makes the processing hard. I'm told we have her good friend Cody present, who I imagine is also grappling with this. I shoot dagger eyes at Alice, because clearly she outed me, but she returns my gaze with a level stare. The guy up front continues, Cody, I'd like to invite you to share, if you'd like, anything about Meg, or share what it is that you're going through. I'm not going up there, I whisper to Alice through gritted teeth. She stares at me, all wide-eyed innocence. What you told me before was so helpful. I thought maybe it would help other people, too. And you. Everyone else is now staring at me. I want to kill Alice, who's nudging me up. Just tell them about the library, about the food for her brother, she whispers. But when I get up there, what comes out isn't cute stories about libraries or bands or picky eaters. You want me to tell you something about Meg? I ask. It's a rhetorical question, and my voice is pure sarcasm. But all those innocent lambs bob their heads encouragingly. Meg was my best friend, and I thought we were everything to each other. I thought we told each other everything. But it turns out I didn't know her at all. I taste something hard and metallic. It's an ugly flavor, but I savor it. The way you relish the taste of your own blood when you have a loose tooth. I didn't know anything about her life here. I didn't know about her classes. I didn't know about her roommates. I didn't know that she'd adopted 2 sick kittens and nursed them back to health only to leave them homeless. I didn't know that she went to clubs in Seattle and had friends up there and crushes on guys who broke her heart. I was supposedly her best friend, and I didn't know any of this because she didn't tell me. She didn't tell me that she found life to be so unbearably painful. I mean, I didn't even have a clue. A kind of laugh escapes, and I know that if I'm not very careful, what follows will be something I don't want to hear, that no one wants to hear. How can you not know that about your best friend? Even if she doesn't tell you, how can you not know? How can you believe someone to be beautiful and amazing and just about the most magical person you've ever known when it turns out she was in such pain that she had to drink poison that robbed her cells of oxygen until her heart had no choice but to stop beating? So don't ask me about Meg, because I don't know shit! Someone gasps. I look out at the crowd, everyone dappled in sunlight. It's a beautiful day, full of the promise of spring, clear skies, puffy clouds, the sweet scent of early flowers blowing in on the breeze. It's wrong that there should be days like this, that spring should come. Some part of me thought it would stay winter this year. I see some people are crying. I made them cry. I've become toxic. Drink me and die. I'm sorry, I say before I bolt. I run off the grassy area, back to the road, heading out of the park toward the main street. I need to get out of here, out of Tacoma, out of Meg's world. I hear footsteps behind me. It's probably Alice or possibly Stoner Richard. But I have nothing to say to them, so I keep running. But whoever's behind is faster than I am. I feel a hand on my shoulder. I spin around. His eyes, this time, look like the color of a sky after sunset. Almost violet. I've never seen someone whose eyes change colors. Like some mood ring to the soul. If he even has a soul. We stare at each other for a minute. Catching our breath. I can tell you things, if you want. His voice has that growl, but there's also a hesitancy. I don't want to know those things. He shakes his head. Not that. But I can tell you things, if you want. About her life here. How would you know, if she was just a one-night stand? He gestures his head in an away-from-here motion. Let's go somewhere and talk. Why are you even here? Her roommate gave me the flyer, he says, answering how he knew about the service, but not why he came. We stand there. Come on. Let's just go talk, he says. Why? Do you know why she killed herself? Recoil. Like the recoil of a gun. That's what he does again. Like he's been physically yanked back. Only this time, it's not anger that's on his face. It's something else. No, he says. We walk a ways to a McDonald's. I'm suddenly ravenous, hungry for something that is not vegetarian or organic or healthy, but is bred in a daily misery. We both get Quarter Pounder extra value meals and take them to a quiet table next to the empty playground. We eat in silence for a while, and then Ben starts talking. He tells me about Meg arriving on the indie band scene, immediately making friends with a lot of the local musicians, which sounds like her. He tells me about how easy it was for her, this 18-year-old college student from bumfuckville, Eastern Washington, swanning in and everyone eating out of her hand. which also sounds like her. At first he was jealous of her, because when he came here from Bend, Oregon 2 years ago, he felt like he'd been hazed by the music community before they'd let him play in the sandbox. He tells me about the faux fights they used to have about who was a better drummer, Keith Moon or John Bonham. Who was a better guitar player, Jimi Hendrix or Ry Cooder? Who wrote the catchiest songs in the world, Nirvana or the Rolling Stones? He tells me about Meg adopting the kittens, hearing them crying in a box in a dumpster near the downtown Tacoma homeless shelter where she worked a few hours a week. She dug them out, brought them to the vet, and spent hundreds of dollars to get them well. He tells me how she hit up some of the more successful musicians in town for donations to pay for the treatments, which again, sounds exactly like Meg, and how she fed them baby formula with eyedroppers because they were too small to eat cat food. Of all the things he tells me, it's this image of Meg coaxing tiny orphan kittens to eat that makes me want to cry. But I don't. Why are you telling me all of this? I ask. Now it's my voice that sounds like a growl. Ben's pack of cigarettes sits on the table, and in lieu of smoking one, he clicks the lighter on and off, the flame hissing each time.
You seemed like you needed to know.
The way he says it sounds like an accusation. Why are you telling me this? I repeat. Ben's eyes are momentarily illuminated by the flame. And once again, I can see there are so many shades of guilt. Ben's, like mine, is tinged with red-hot fury, hotter than the fire he's toying with.
She talked about you, you know,
he says. Really? She didn't talk about you?
Which is untrue, of course, but I won't give him the satisfaction of knowing she had a moniker for him.
Anyhow, turns out that he wasn't the tragic one.
She told me how at one of your cleaning jobs, some guy tried to grab your ass, and you twisted his arm so far behind his back that he yelped and then upped your pay.
Yeah, that happened to me with Mr. Perdue. A $10-a-week raise. That's how much an unwanted cop of my ass is worth.
She called you Buffy.
And more than the thing with Mr. Perdue, that's how I know that Meg did tell him about me. Buffy was her nickname for me when she thought I was being particularly kick-ass, a la Buffy Summers, the vampire slayer. She called herself Willow, the magical sidekick. But she had it wrong. She was Buffy and Willow, strength and magic, all folded into one. I was just basking in her glow. It feels wrong that he knows this about me, like he has seen my embarrassing baby pictures. Details he has no right to. She told you a lot for a one-night stand, I say. He looks pained. What a good faker he is, that Ben McAllister.
We used to be friends.
I'm not sure friends is the word for it.
No,
he insists. Before it all shot to shit, we were friends. The emails. The banter. The rock talk. The sudden change. So what happened? I ask,
even though I know what happened.
Still, it's shocking to hear him say it, the way he says it.
We fucked.
You slept together, I correct, because I know that much. I know that Meg, after what happened to her that other time, would not have done that with someone unless she was into him. Meg wouldn't just fuck someone.
Well, I fucked her. Ben repeats, and when you fuck a friend, it ruins everything.
He flicks the lighter on and lets it go dark again.
I knew it would, and I still did it.
Now that he's being honest, it's both repellent and magnetic, like a terrible car crash you can't help rubbernecking, even though you know it'll give you nightmares later. Why would you do that? If you knew that it would ruin things. He sighs and shakes his head.
You know how it is, when it's in the moment and it's all happening, and you don't think about the day after.
He looks at me, but the thing is, I don't know. It would probably shock people to learn, but I've never.
When you are bred to be white trash, you do what you can to avoid the family trap. Most of the time it seems inevitable anyway. Still, I didn't need put a nail in the coffin by screwing any of the losers in Shitburg. I don't say anything. Just stare at the empty playground. We only did it the once, but it was enough. Right after, everything went south. When? I ask. I don't know. Around Thanksgiving? Why? That makes sense. Her sleeping with the bartender email came before the holidays. But the kittens? Those she found after winter break. And the thing with Mr. Perdue grabbing my ass had happened in February, a few weeks before she died. But if things went south a while ago, how do you know all this recent stuff about the cats? About me? I thought you read the emails. Only a couple. He grimaces. So, you didn't see all the stuff she wrote me? No, and a bunch of her mail is missing between, like, January and the week before she died. A puzzled look passes over Ben's face. Do you have a computer here? I can use Meg's, in her room. He pauses as if considering. Then he crumples up our empty food wrappers. Let's go. Back in Meg's room, he launches his webmail program. He does a search for her name, and a whole screen of emails pop up. He scoots out of the chair, and I sit down in it. Repeat comes bounding through the open door to claw at the cardboard boxes. I start at the beginning. The flirty banter, all the stuff about Keith Moon and the Rolling Stones. I look at Ben. Keep going, he says. And I do. The flirtation grows. The emails get longer. And then they sleep together. It's like a black line drawn in space. Because after, Ben's emails become distant, and Meg's kind of desperate. And then they just get weird. Maybe if they were written to me, they wouldn't seem so weird. Except they were to Ben, a guy she slept with once. She wrote him pages and pages of stuff. Everything about her life. The cats. Me. It reads like very detailed journal entries. The more he tried to push her away, the more she wrote. She wasn't totally clueless. It's clear she knew what she was doing was odd because she ended several notes, some of which were 8 or 10 pages long, with a need for reassurance. We're still friends, right? Like she's asking for permission to keep telling him all this stuff. I'm embarrassed to be reading this, embarrassed on her behalf, too. Is this why she deleted her sent mail? The emails to Ben go on like this every few days, for several weeks, and it's impossible to read them all, not just because they're long, but because they're giving me a horrible twist in my gut. Within the emails are references to texts and phone calls she made to him. When I ask Ben how often, he doesn't answer. And then I see one of his last emails to her. Find someone else to talk to, he told her. Shortly after that email, you have to leave me alone. And then I think of her last email to him. You don't have to worry about me anymore. I have to stop. Ben is now looking at me with an expression I don't like. I prefer the cocky, strutting asshole from a few nights ago. Because I want to hate Ben McAllister, I don't want him looking at me with soft eyes. I don't want him looking vulnerable, almost needy, like he wants reassurance. And I certainly don't want him doing something generous, like offering to take the kittens off my hands, which is what he does. I just stare at him like, who are you? I'll leave them with my mom next time I go to Bend. It's pretty much a zoo at her place anyway, so she won't give a shit about two more strays. What about until then? I ask. I share a house in Seattle. It's got a backyard. And my housemates are all vegans. Big into animal rights. So they can't say no. Or they'll risk looking like hypocrites. Why would you do that? I ask. I don't know why I'm challenging him. I need to find a home for the cats. Ben's the only taker. I should shut up.
I thought I'd just explain why,
he says. The growl back in his voice is a relief. But by the way he's looking at everything in the room but me, I think he knows that he didn't really explain why. And by the way I'm looking at everything in the room but him, I know that I don't really need him to. The next morning, Ben comes by the house for the cats as I'm finishing taping up the last of the boxes. I put Pete and Repeat into their carrier, collect all their toys, and hand them over.
Where are you headed?
He asks me. UPS depot and bus station?
I can give you a lift.
That's okay. I'll call a cab. One of the cats yowls from the carrier.
Don't be stupid, Ben says. You'll have to pay for 2 cabs.
I'm half afraid Ben will rescind his offer to take the cats, and that's why he's offering the ride. But he's already loading the duffel bags into the trunk and putting the cats in the back. The car is filthy, full of empty Red Bull cans, smelling of cigarettes. There's a beaded cardigan balled up in the back seat. The mysterious roommate, Harry Kang, helps us haul the boxes to the car, and though we have not exchanged 2 words during my entire stay, he grasps my hand and says, "Please tell Meg's family that my family has been praying for them every day." He looks at me a moment longer. "I'm going to tell them to pray for you, too." And though people have been saying this crap to me all the time since Meg died, Harry's unexpected words bring a lump to my throat. Pete and Repeat yowl all the way to the UPS place, and Ben waits with them in the car while I ship the boxes. Then Ben drives me to the bus station in time for the 1 p.m. bus. I'll be home for dinner. Not that there'll be dinner. The cats continue to screech the whole time, and by the time we get to the bus station, it smells like one of them has peed. By this point, I'm convinced he's going to say he changed his mind, that the offer to take them was basically his revenge for my t-shirt email. But he doesn't. When I open the door in front of the bus station, he says, "Take care, Cody," in a quiet voice. I suddenly wish I were taking the cats. The thought of returning home alone makes me desolate. As much as I want to put miles between me and Ben McAllister, now that I'm doing just that, I understand what a relief it's been to share this weight with someone. "Yeah. You too," I tell him. "Have a good life." It's not what I meant to say. It sounds too flippant. But maybe it's the most you can hope for someone. Chapter 10. The bus breaks down with a flat tire in the mountains, so I miss my connection in Ellensburg, and it's after midnight when I get home. I sleep until 8, go clean the Thomas house, and then that night, I lug the 2 bags over to the Garcias. I ring the bell, which is something I rarely ever did before, and Scotty answers. When he opens the door, I ask how it's going, but I don't need to ask, because I smell butter. "Cupcakes," he says. "Delicious," I say, attempting some cheer. Scotty shakes his head. "I never thought I'd say this, but I'd like some broccoli right about now." Joe and Sue hesitate when they see me, as if it's not Meg's clothes and books I've brought back, but Meg herself. Then they come forward and are thanking me, and Sue is crying silently, and it's just too much to bear. I know they love me. Sue has long said she loves me like a daughter. But it's different now that she doesn't actually have a daughter. I turn to Scotty. If this is hard on me, it's worse for him. So, as if I'm Santa unpacking gifts, I say, "Shall we see what we've got?" Except no one wants to see it. So I pull out her laptop, which I've kept separate in my backpack. I hold it out to Joe and Sue. They look at each other, then they shake their heads. "We discussed it," Joe says, "and we want you to have it." "Me?" I know how expensive this computer was. "No, I can't." "Please, we We want you to, Sue says.
What about Scotty?
Scotty is 10, Joe says. We have the family computer. He has plenty of time to have his own laptop. Sue's face falters, as if she no longer trusts the promise of time. But she pulls it together and says,
And you'll need it for when you go away to college.
I nod, and we all pretend like this is going to happen.
It's too much, I say.
Cody, take it,
Joe says almost harshly. I understand then that giving me the computer is not really a gift, but maybe my taking it is. When it's time to leave, Sue packs up a dozen cupcakes to take home, their frosted pink and gold, colors that tell a story of sweetness and joy. Even food lies. Scotty takes Samson out for a walk and joins me half the way home. Sorry about the computer, Runtmeyer. It's okay. I can play DS. You can come over and teach me to play one of your games. He looks at me seriously.
Okay, but you can't let me win. I feel like people are letting me win because I'm the dead girl's brother.
I nod. I'm the dead girl's best friend, so it's an even playing field, which frees me up to totally kick your butt. It's the first time I see Scotty smile in ages. When I get home, Trisha is there, nuking a lean cuisine.
Want one?
She asks. This is the height of mothering for her. We sit down to Chinese chicken, and I show her the laptop. She runs her hands over it, impressed. And I wonder if she resents that the Garcias have provided me another thing that she can't. This in addition to all the dinners, the family camping trips, everything that they gave me while Trisha was working at the bar or out with one of her boyfriends. I've always wondered how to work one of these, she says. I shake my head. I can't believe you still don't know how to use a computer. She shrugs.
I've got this far, and I know how to text. Raymond showed me.
I don't ask who Raymond is. I don't need to know that he's the latest guy. Trisha never bothers bringing them around or introducing me, unless we happen to bump into each other, which is just as well. They've usually dumped her by the time it takes me to learn a name. We eat our meals. Trisha doesn't want one of Sue's cupcakes because they're fattening, and I don't want one either. So Trisha digs around for low-fat fudgesicles with only moderate amounts of freezer burn.
What was with the cats? She asks me.
Huh?
You asked if we could have cats. Are you trying to fill up the gap left by Meg with a pet or something?
I choke on my fudgesicle. No. And then I almost tell her. Because I want to tell someone about Meg's cats, about her whole life there that I knew nothing about. But I'm pretty sure the Garcias didn't know about it either. And this town is small. If I tell Trisha about the cats, she will invariably tell someone, and it'll get back to Joe and Sue. There were a couple of kittens, and they needed homes. She shakes her head. You can't give homes to every stray out there. She says this like people are constantly knocking down our door for a nice, dry, warm place to stay. When in fact, we are the strays.
Chapter 11.
An academic advisor from the community college leaves me a message, saying that they are aware of my extenuating circumstances, and if I want to come in for a meeting, he will help me find a way to fix my record. Madison, a girl who'd been in most of my classes at school, also calls, leaving another, "Are you okay?" message. I don't return either call. I go back to work, picking up a few more cleaning jobs, 6 a week now, decent money. Meg's laptop stays on my desk, along with the rest of my school books, all of them collecting dust. Until one afternoon, the doorbell rings. Scotty is on the porch with Samson, who's tied up to a rail.
I'm here to take you up on your offer to kick my butt, he says.
Come on in. We fire up the computer. What are we playing? I ask.
I thought we'd start with Soldier of Solitude.
What's that?
Here, I'll show you.
He clicks on the web.